Oh, it was another hard week with Mark's gospel. I love it because he's so crisp and clear about what it is we're supposed to do. But my gosh, he does not let us wiggle out from underneath the sharp edges of our faith story of God's good news. We want to think about good news as something warm and fuzzy, something that comforts us and makes us happy and move forward content with our lives, makes people feel joyful and grateful. But Mark's gospel took us from baptism to the wilderness last week. And now we fast forward to chapter 8, where Jesus is telling his disciples that he's going to be betrayed and killed. It's a very hard story. Jesus and his disciples go set out for the villages around Caesarea Philippi, which is 25 miles north of the Sea of Galilee. Jesus is outside his comfort zone. The disciples and he are going into a territory where they really don't know what lies before them. They are going to a place where ancient Israel used to extend the borderlands. That is Mark's Jesus. He was always in the borderlands. Jesus is suddenly speaking openly after he's been so reluctant to talk about himself or be talked about. In this week's gospel reading from Mark, Jesus predicts his death for the first time. The Son of Man must undergo great suffering, Jesus tells his disciples quite plainly. He must be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. Whew! That's a heavy thing to lay on your disciples who've only been with you for a short while. Standing on this side of resurrection history, we too easily miss the bombshell effect these words must have had on Jesus' disciples. Their great hope, cultivated over the 3 years that they followed Jesus, was that he would lead them in a military revolution and overthrow their Roman oppressors. After all, they had seen his miracles and witnessed firsthand his charismatic ability to draw huge crowds to him. They had heard him proclaim loud and clear the arrival of the kingdom of God. He was their longed-for future, their cherished dreams. So what could be more horrifying than the news that their would-be champion was determined to walk straight into a death trap, to surrender without a fight to a common criminal's death? You can imagine that this isn't a very popular thing to tell people in the new members class. They're likely not to come back to church, so it's a good thing that Mark waits until the 8th chapter to wade into this. What Jesus says to his disciples scares them to death, and rightly so. Peter took him aside to argue with him. We can imagine what he might have said to Jesus. Look, you don't have to go walk right into the lion's mouth. For heaven's sake, we're just getting started in our ministry. We need you. And don't be telling people that they have to pick up their cross and follow you. That's not good public relations. Jesus rebukes Peter in a manner that we rarely see when he says, "Get out of my sight, Satan. You're judging me by human standards rather than God's." Then Jesus turns to the crowds and captures the essence of his message in two sentences. "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it." Whew, that's a really complicated knot to try to untie in 20 minutes in a sermon. And to tell you the truth, this has been taught in a way that I think limits the good news effect in and through our lives. I don't know about you, but I can relate very well to Peter's unease about the hard, hard teaching that Jesus has for us this morning. Even now, centuries removed from the context in which Jesus lived and taught, I shiver as I consider the implications of his words. What exactly was he saying? That he wants us to pursue suffering and death? That a holy life is not about living at all, but about dying? About martyrdom? I remember when I first felt my call to ministry, I was immediately terrified at what cost would come with that following God's call to me. I understood this passage as something that meant that I was called to stand in the midst of suffering and have suffering be a part of my life for my whole life long, and maybe even be a martyr. And I was frightened. I was fortunate to have a church, and I walked with people who knew the way of the cross is a hard one, but also knew the good news of God's rising in and through us, even after really terrible things happen to God's people. One temptation that we have during Lent is to minimize this story, to say, I'll give up dot, dot, dot for Lent. You know, I'll give up cursing, I'll give up chocolate, or say, I'll fast from Facebook or from YouTube for a few weeks, even if it means that I'm only doing it so that I can watch the Winter Olympics. But I don't think that this is what Jesus meant when he invited the crowds to lose their lives for the sake of the gospel, for the sake of God's good news for all God's people. Peter tried to replace Jesus' cross with a shortcut. There is no shortcut to resurrection. The other temptation is to maximize in the wrong direction, to become, as the expression says, quote, so heavenly minded that we're no earthly good, end quote. This is the kind of self-denial that strips life of all pleasure, all embodiment, all celebration, all joy. The single-mindedness that reduces the world to a grim mission field, a landscape to conquer with the earnest but ultimately loveless zeal. You know the types. All churches have them. It's the dangerous kind of self-denial that encourages people to stay in abusive relationships and to perpetuate their own victimhood or their own sense of victimhood. I don't believe that this is what Jesus meant either. I can't recognize it in the Jesus who frolicked with children, the Jesus who turned water into wine, the Jesus who advocated for the widow, the orphan, the prisoner, the alien, the outcast. So what then? What does it mean to take up our cross and follow Jesus, to lose our life for the sake of God's good news? This week, I've asked myself these questions in light of the tragedy in Florida, and I've been struck with one realization, that to pick up our cross and follow Jesus is to recognize that we, as a culture, live with such a crippling fear of suffering and death that we use up a huge amount of our mental and spiritual and physical energy each day trying to stave off death. Debbie Thomas writes in her article, "What, after all, do people who own 300 million guns have to say about fear, about being held hostage by fear? What would it look like in this time and place to lay down our fears so that others might live, to willingly set aside our own interests and, dare I say, our own rights, so that we could prioritize what Jesus called the great commandments, to love God and love our neighbor as ourselves?" In Jesus' time, crosses were used by Romans to instill fear into Roman subjects in order to keep them quiet and calm and subdued. The cross was adopted by the Roman Empire with the intent to frighten and intimidate people. Crosses, nowhere was this more evident than in their domination of the Jews. Crosses were a constant symbol of Roman rule, as thousands of Judeans were executed on crosses. Crosses were put up around Judea, sometimes with body hanging on them, decaying, reminding people of the torturous and slow death of crucifixion, of the ramifications of them standing against the principalities and powers and following Jesus. I've always assumed that when Jesus told his disciples and us to take up their or our cross and follow, that he meant to each person to take up our, his, her, or their particular cross and carry it, that we were to shoulder whatever suffering we were born into and created and walk to our death carrying that. You were born to suffer, that you were beaten, that you live in a loveless relationship. You were born to have terrible things happen in your life, pick up your cross. It's part of your life, and God gave you this gift to carry through your life. And I don't believe at all that that's what Jesus meant to say here. Contemporary Western culture engenders fear in us. Multi-million dollar industries invite us to deny our mortality through cosmetics, fashion, leisure, sex, entertainment, real estate, sports cars, weight loss, and beauty. The dominant culture in our world today glorifies violence and cheapens death. What would Jesus say to our frightened hearts that prioritize self-protection over so much else that matters in this life? What if Jesus' call is for us to stop clutching at this life so desperately, to step out of the vicious cycles of denial, acquisition, and terror, and violence that seek to cheat death, but in fact cause us to lose ourselves in a soul-numbing life? We still have crossed posted all around us today. If you're black or brown or undocumented or poor or female or disabled or elderly or mentally ill or a convicted felon, you're more likely than not to end up with a target on your chest. Our ministry as Christians is to stop the crucifixions, to take up the crosses meant to inflict harm and say, no more will innocent people be crucified by public policies of discrimination, subjugation, intimidation, and domination. This image up here is one that I found very compelling. It's called Our Lady of Ferguson and All Those Killed by Gun Violence. The icon was commissioned by the Reverend Dr. Mark Bozzuti Jones at Trinity Episcopal Church on Wall Street. And it was written because, you see, art icons like this are not painted. They're written by Mark Dukes to recognize the victims of gun violence. It's on display at Trinity Church. This icon combines Mary, who we see as an African-American or an African, a dark-skinned woman, and a child caught in the crosshairs of a gun, with the Sacred Heart of Jesus in the middle of the child's chest, symbolizing God's compassion for the whole world, the one great heart that encircles us all. Mary, the God-bearer, is always depicted in iconography wearing the blue of humanity closest to her body and the red of divinity over the blue. In this image, Mary holds her arms in a position of prayer and supplication. It references Isaiah 7:14. Therefore, the Holy One will give you a sign. This young woman will become pregnant and will give birth. You will name the child Emmanuel, God with us. This is a visual sign to us today of Christ's continuing presence in us and in the womb of the world. God with us. In this icon, Mary is depicted as an African-American woman, emphasizing her presence in the black community, in the community of refugees and migrants. Mary, too, lost her child to a violent death and new grief, and she comforts all mothers and fathers who have suffered the loss of children and all those who are left behind. This icon is a challenge to us. It disturbs our comfortable notion of the Madonna and Child, which we so often see as a white Mary in all of her fine regalia holding a lovely white child, also in regal dress. This icon slams us right into the presence as Jesus' question hangs in the air. Who do you say I am? Matthew's gospel says, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or homeless or naked or ill or in prison and not take care of you? The answer will come. The truth is, often as you neglected to do this for one of the least of these, you neglected to do it for me. Debbie Thomas says, quote, to take up a cross as Jesus did is to recognize Christ crucified in every suffering soul and body that surrounds us, and pour our energies and our lives into alleviating that pain. In the case of our American epidemic of gun violence, she writes, it means moving beyond the band-aid approach of thoughts and prayers and deciding as a church, as Jesus's body on earth, as Christians committed to peace, justice, and human flourishing, that we will not tolerate this desecration of life in our schools or our churches or our cities anymore. I'm not sure how to end this sermon. I'm left with that haunting question that Jesus asks, who do we say Jesus is? I look at the child and the crosshairs of the gun in Mary's womb, and I say, Scott, Alyssa, Martin, Nicholas, Aaron, Jamie, Christopher, Luke, Kara, Gina, Joaquin, Alania, Meadow, Helena, Alex, Carmen, Peter. Amen.